Good morning. This is Matt Winters, editor of the Chinook Observer in Long Beach, Washington. I'm here in our After Deadline program on KMUN, where we get together with interesting local people and talk about the news of the day and what's ahead in many cases. With me here this morning is Charlie Stenvall, who is the overall manager of Wildlife Refuge, National Wildlife Refuge lands, primarily on Willapa Bay, but also encompassing many of the islands upriver from us. And we're here specifically this morning largely to talk about the refuge's plans for both the immediate future and stretching out on into the more distant future. This discussion having been sparked by the issuance just in the last few days of an environmental impact statement that gets into some of the details about the refuge system's plans here. Charlie, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for inviting me, Matt. Appreciate it.
Yeah. We were just talking with our engineer here, Terry Wilson, right before we came on the air about Tarlet Slough, which is on the very far southwest end of Willapa Bay. And interestingly enough, it sort of is a focal point of some of these plans, or close to a focal point of it. For me personally, I was telling Charlie before we came on the air that I'm a great personal fan of the Wildlife Refuge System and spend a good deal of time out there over the years, and Tarlet Slough is particularly near and dear to my heart because it's one of the places I've had my most success in seeing river otters. One of my, if I want to be reincarnated as anything, it's probably as a river otter.
Yep.
And a really delightful area of our region. Wildlife Refuge System in general is a very under-known, underappreciated asset for our area, both sides of the river. Charlie, would you sort of briefly outline what your holdings are, some of the prime mission or star attractions, I guess, of the Wildlife Refuge here?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, there are nationwide, there's over 550 National Wildlife Refuges, and National Wildlife Refuges are the primary federal lands that are managed specifically for wildlife. That is their primary purpose. And in this area of the country, the three refuges that are managed out of my office, the Lewis and Clark Refuge, which is basically the Columbia River Islands from Tongue Point up to Kathlamet. It's a fantastic place if you've ever spent time out there. There's not a lot of active management going on. It's pretty much a protection and, natural processes refuge. And it's known for birds, waterfowl. This time of year, there's a lot of divers out there. Scop, it's a pretty big place for scop. Mm-hmm. You get a lot of swans, and it's kind of a fantastic place. Also an important place for salmonids. I mean, it's a big area for juvenile salmonids on their way out to the ocean. Just upstream from that, of course, then is the Julia Butler Hansen Refuge for the Columbian white-tailed deer, and that's for the most part, a single species refuge. I mean, it was established to manage for Columbian white-tailed deer. They're endangered. They're one of the first endangered species on the endangered species list, and we have a set of goals in terms of numbers that we're managing for, and it's not that we don't have other wildlife out there. We do. I mean, there's so a lot of things are compatible with Columbian white-tailed deer management.
Is it succeeding in terms of bringing the Columbia white-tailed deer back, or what is the status of them now?
Well, it's a slow process. We've been working hard at sort of trying to expand their range and expand their numbers. We have the recovery plan is fairly dated. It's an old recovery plan, but it basically states we have to have 400 animals in three separate subpopulations on secure habitat. Now, the definition of secure habitat is a little vague. What constitutes secure habitat, but we have three subpopulations right now established on what we consider secure habitat, either refuge ownership or state land ownership. What we don't have is the 400 animals. Yeah, we aren't there, and we're managing at fairly high densities in these areas. I mean, we're trying to manage for deer that are You know, right now, about 35 to 40 deer per square mile, which is fairly high. Mm. And so when you do that, we're subject to, you know, issues like if you're on the mainland portion of the refuge, we've had flooding issues for a couple of years in a row, which really impacted our numbers. Right now, I think we're getting close to our management goals on a lot of those units, but we don't have 400 animals.
Mm-hmm. And then you're going to move on to the Willapa Bay-related resource.
Right. Willapa. Well, Willapa is just a little bit of everything fantastic. You know, it's from coastal dune habitats to old-growth forest to streams to estuary. It sort of has it all, from forest birds to snowy plovers to salmonids to you name it, amphibians, bats. It just has a little bit of everything. Every day you can go out and sort of be fascinated about some aspect of natural history that you weren't aware of.
Right. Well, in my long walks out there, you always see something new, or you at least have the potential of seeing something new, from elk or great blue heron are sort of ubiquitous in our area, but it still never fails to startle and amaze me, I guess, when you walk up to one of them and they have such a dinosaur kind of sound. And
Those are the obvious ones. You have things like Western brook lamprey, which we've been working on, and they're a fascinating little species too. They're basically a non-anadromous lamprey that for 7 years of their life live in the mud, and then that seventh year they come out and spawn and die. And they're just sort of there's just all sorts of really fascinating aspects to sort of the wildlife. Some of it you see regularly, some things you don't.
Right. Yeah. I've thought over the years that I'd love to do a better job than we do at the Observer of almost doing a species of the month or a club or something, and maybe I'll look to you over the course of time and we can move on that, because I think people really get a richer awareness and appreciation for our area when they know sort of what our natural neighbors are, in a sense. And we're all, I think, we laymen in the field so woefully ignorant about it all that But it really is an incredible place. Your headquarters, however, is an interesting kind of throwback. Nothing really unusual in that, I think, in the wildlife refuge system, in that it tends to not probably be very lavishly funded by any stretch of the imagination. So your headquarters, which is on the shore of the bay, kind of in the channel between the bay and Long Island, as a person is driving up U.S. Highway 101 between the peninsula and South Bend. It's familiar to most of us, at least in Pacific County, from driving on the highway. I was admitting to you earlier that I've never actually stepped foot in the place myself. My gifted photographer, Damian Mullinex, was out last week, or was it this week, in preparation for our story on this subject, and was and came back sort of amused and befuddled to see how many people and activities you jam into a place that doesn't function very well as a physical plant. Can you sort of describe the setting for our listeners?
It's a quaint sight. I think it would be might be a way to describe it. It was one of the first holdings that the refuge acquired back when the refuge was established back in 1937. And so it was a logical place to, build some facilities there, shop building, a house. And the house has been converted to an office. And we have, it's a little narrow river valley there. There's a lot of us packed in there. We don't have, running water a lot of times. I think Damien might have been amused or appalled at, sort of the number of mice we're dumping in the garbage can on a daily basis. And quite frankly, as I mentioned to you, I could work out of a pup tent, because we really are all focused on the resource and sort of the resource work that we have to do. But when you manage for a refuge and you're managing for wildland, you don't want to have your facilities scattered all over the place. There's all sorts of associated impacts that occur with that. We've impacted that stream that's there. We have marble murrelet habitat on that surrounds us there, and it's not a place for airboats to be, lighting up their motors. I mean, anybody who's heard an airboat motor knows what that's like. And it's quite frankly not in sort of the best place for us to deal with and interact with the public. I mean, it's kind of a highway way stop is what it is. I think probably we get more visitors there that use the restroom facility than anything else. And so we are looking to relocate, you know, if, you know, and we're, you know, nationally, I think the Fish and Wildlife Service has that facility ranked as 18th for replacement in the nation. The question is if we're going to rebuild and put in a new facility, is that the appropriate place for it? And the answer is probably clearly no. I mean, at Long Beach Peninsula makes a lot of sense. There's a population base there. It's on the edge and the periphery of the refuge. There is water there. You know, that's fantastic. The simple thing, then we can engage with the public and we can put it in a, you know, we've got some Tarlet Slough is an area where we're looking at. Mm-hmm. And in addition to Tarlet Slough, you know, we're looking at doing some habitat work there to get the early blue violet sort of successional habitat reestablished in Tarlet Slough and hopefully the Oregon silver spot butterfly back into the Long Beach Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And butterflies and people, they work well together. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not a problem. And so, you know, there's a lot of reasons why that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. We've done some coverage in the Observer, and I don't think it was a story amongst those that the Astorian occasionally picks up that explains this for our readers, but for those who may not be quite as familiar with it, the Oregon silver spot butterfly is a seriously endangered species up and down the coast, and it relies on, I guess, this one species of picturesque little violet that you're working on, or thinking, I guess, about reestablishing in sort of a broad pasture-like area that you acquired a number of years ago on Sandridge Road, kind of just east of Sandridge Road between Sandridge and the bay, Lower Bay. And so you've had a practice of in recent years of taking children out on school field trips there, and it's a neat little package of restoration activities in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it is. That's where all the fourth grade environmental that's where the field trips for all the fourth grade classes that we engage with. You know, have a year long with the friends group. Have a year long education program with all the fourth grade classes, and then it culminates with a field trip, and it's out there that we conduct it. And there's, you know, it's a great place for them to get their hands on amphibians or look at birds, or, you know, it's getting kids outside and connected is really kind of a key thing that we're interested in.
Well, it gives you a lot of opportunities for sort of multidisciplinary study of everything from drawing a picture of wildlife to studying their biology and habitats. So it's a nice fit with the local school system.
Right.
You mentioned the friends group. That's another aspect of your community relationship that I've promised to do a separate show on at some point that I think, an interesting and dynamic organization on the peninsula, and another one of many on the peninsula that labors on in relative anonymity and silence, but does a lot of great things. And so it's the Friends of the Willapa Bay National Wildlife Refuge, or something to that effect. And, you know, as I say, I'll do a separate show on that. Getting into, let me remind listeners before I do that I'm here this morning with Charlie Stenvall, the complex manager. Is that your title?
Or? Oh, man, titles, I'll tell you. I think the official title is project leader, but it's just refuge manager.
Okay. All right. Well, Charlie Stenvall, anyway, with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who manages our complex of wildlife refuges that stretches from the northern tip of, well, even beyond that, to the northern entrance, I guess, of Willapa Bay, all the way upriver to some of the Columbia River Islands far to our east. And we're here after deadline on KMUN. And the reason, I guess, I invited you specifically this morning, other than just getting caught up with an important local set of assets, is that we have this environmental impact statement, I don't know, 4 pounds or whatever it is resting in my lap at the moment, that just came out, and it's been long awaited, been bubbling through public meetings and the government printing office, and so it's just finally now in hand. It can be all accessed, I believe, online if people are curious to go blow by blow. But it goes through three options for the upcoming future of the wildlife refuge system. Option one, I think, is essentially not to do very much.
It's the status quo.
Yeah. The preferred option is two, which gets into some of the moving of the refuge headquarters to a location near Tarlet Slough, I gather. And frankly, I haven't found time to read option three, and you can mention it to whatever extent you want. But thinking about doing nothing, which is option one, is that truly an option? And, you know, if not, why should we prefer option two?
Well, option one is when you we're doing an environmental impact statement because there's so many things that we're trying to tackle in this plan, and in an environmental impact statement, you're basically your option is your status quo, which would be option one, in which you then evaluate the changes of your other two options against that, and how you do your analysis. And we spent a lot of time. It's been 2 years in the works, and it's, I don't know, some 800 pages. It's, like I said, it's a document for insomniacs and lawyers, I think, more than anything else. But there is a lot of good information in there, and sort of our rationale of why we're going about it, and the legal reasons, and sort of our obligations in the Fish and Wildlife Service. And there's a lot of information to gather out of there, because I think to some folks, that's probably not even, you know, they're not even aware of sort of where our obligations lie on that. When you look at what we're trying to tackle, I mean, we're tackling things from, you know, our snowy plover and coastal dune restoration habitat work that we're doing up at Leadbetter. And up there, the issue is, at this point for us, our snowy plovers, when we have the largest breeding population in the state of Washington up there, but we don't have very successful breeding. We've dealt with all the habitat issues in terms of the invasive beach grass and removing that and getting substrate, and we've been putting exclosures over nests, but it's corvid predation on the young and the crows and ravens, and we have a high corvid population on the peninsula. They do well in a rural-urban interface, and there's a few smart birds that sort of learn to do a search pattern for these young. And so we're, you know, in this we're proposing that we would institute some sort of lethal control on the problem birds to sort of get our productivity up where it should be. If you move further down south in the bay, Tarlet Slough, yes, our office site, Oregon silver spot butterfly, that's in the plan. If you look at our our forest management, we're talking about, you know, continuing to work on the forest lands to establish or reestablish old growth characteristics, which is going to take us a long time. I mean, it's kind of a new unknown science.
Multi-generational sort of thing.
It is, and, you know, it's hard enough to plan 15 years out because so many things can change. But when you're talking about, you know, you're measuring your success in 100 years out, that's really daunting. But it's something that, we're moving down, working on that. We're talking about, and we still are working on, you know, any fish issues that we have to do, fish passage barriers, reestablishing runs and species and streams. That's part of the plan. As is a big change, which is we have about 750 acres in South Bay that's behind a dike. And the dike in South Bay was constructed by the refuge in the late 40s, early 50s. It's an interesting thing reading the rationale for why that was put in. There are some ideas that maybe we could produce more waterfowl. There was definitely some ideas of increasing food source for waterfowl. But you know, we've got the dikes in there. We've spent a lot of time looking at that, and indeed, you know, quite some time ago there was an idea of whether we should be taking down those dikes and restoring the estuary habitat then. And I wasn't willing to look at that because we were in the midst of Spartina, and I didn't want to see, you know, the last little remnants of habitat that we could manage, you know, go into a Spartina pit, because there's no guarantee that we were going to be anywhere successful on Spartina. But that's changed, and you know, the historical records are pretty clear. That place was a fabulous place for waterfowl. It is still. I mean, a lot of goose use, a lot of duck use occurs in the salt marsh. Now there's not Spartina there. We don't shorebird use is all out in the estuary. We don't have, basically, we do have some goose use and we do have some waterfowl use, but it requires a lot of intensive manipulation and management. If we do it right, it works out pretty well. But if we do, I could guarantee you, we could mismanage it. In a couple of years, we'd have nothing behind those dikes. The idea is that, there's a lot of places in the country where you can't do a restoration and sort of let it go back to what it used to be. I worked in the Central Valley of California managing waterfowl refuge there. And that place, it has dams and the natural flooding regime doesn't exist anymore. And if you want to have waterfowl and mimic the old historical patterns, you're basically flipping on a pump or calling up the irrigation district and asking for a delivery of water. That's not the case here. And, with tight budgets and sort of where we need to go with looking at things, there, Willapa Bay, when it's in its heyday and even now, it's hard to beat. There's not a lot we can do to improve on that in some cases, and that would be the case here too. The other thing is that, our dike out there was built with a drag line way back in the day. And dikes are taking a lot more scrutiny now, especially after Hurricane Katrina. Anything that's a federal, it's a dike. And we've had some initial cost estimates because the dike's not in good shape. We have, we've done some work out there. We've done a lot of maintenance work over the last 10 years. But, the fish ladders that we installed, they have some maintenance issues. One of them's structurally starting to fail. I mean, go figure, building something out on a mud flat, you're going to have structural issues. I mean, that just comes with the territory. But the dike itself is not in good shape. And, we've gotten some preliminary cost estimates from our civil engineering department in Portland. And it's a phenomenal amount of money to have to bring those up to code. I mean, and the code and the standard is set by the Army Corps of Engineers. We're following their dike and levee construction.
There's not a lot of wiggle room there.
Well, it's a lot of money, though. I mean, millions upon millions. I almost don't even want to mention the figure because it seems mind-boggling to me.
Right.
But having a dike that doesn't really quite meet our resource goals and requires a lot of intensive management, when you can get probably better resource goals without that intensive management, I think it's not a bad place to be. And you tie in, if we can restore and sort of recover sort of what it used to be and the species that used to be there, and then let people enjoy the refuge as it is, that's not a bad way to go. I think.
Well, that's an interesting sort of scenario. In essence, it sounds like in a lot of places where you're managing for waterfowl and migratory species, it's almost like a human machine that has to be constantly tinkered with and maintained, whereas at Willapa, you have the potential of having something that maintains itself and runs just fine as a natural system if you back out what we've already apparently somewhat mistakenly done.
Well, I think the interesting thing is that science changes and our knowledge changes. I mean, back in the late 40s and 50s, that was a pretty, that was a pretty good mindset to do that. I mean, I can also tell you that I can look at our historical documents in the 50s, and at that time, we were hoping that Spartina would spread because it was great waterfowl food. Mm-hmm. I mean, that came true, but it wasn't, it spread. It wasn't quite what we thought it was going to be. So, things do change, and, nothing's ever, our state of knowledge and learning is always, should always be in a state of flux.
I don't want to get into Spartina to any great extent. We'd be here all day, but just for those who may not know all about it, even the sort of genesis of it is somewhat controversial, but the prevailing theory is that it was accidentally introduced in the process of oyster cultivation a long, long time ago from, possibly the East Coast, and that it found an environment that was just lovely for it, and it just took off it sort of simmered for a long time, and then it really took off, and when I moved here 20 years ago, people were worried about essentially losing all the productive tidal flats of the bay to what would become sort of a monoculture and not much else except for this tall, perfectly attractive grass, but, it's a grass that wasn't intended to be here. So there was this long, long struggle, and people really got riled up about it because it partly involved use of chemicals, but it really has been, at this point, largely successfully beat back. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to see the bird use back. Mm-hmm. Where we, you know, I've seen, you know, it has been tremendous in that standpoint. It's not done though. Mm-hmm. I mean, we still have a small amount out there. It's now the needle in the haystack type mm-hmm. type program where we're out looking for individual yeah. plants, and this is the tough part. And there's a lot of the counties involved and the state agencies are involved. The oyster growers are involved. I mean, there's a lot of people still involved trying to bring this thing to an end point, because the idea is to be done with it and then focus on, you know, nobody wants this to be in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. But it's the last steps that are probably the hardest, because mm-hmm. you're doing a search and destroy type thing. So
what are the next steps for this refuge planning process? We're down to the last, you know, 3 minutes or so of the show. I gather the public input part, the in-person part's largely over, but people can comment on this if they choose to. And
correct. Yeah. Right now, there's it's out for public comment, and we would like to get those comments in writing. So we have those in writing, and that comment period closes March 7th. Mm-hmm. At that point, we will compile all the comments, take a look at what's said, and if there's some things that we haven't seen or we weren't aware of, or there's some new data sets that might have us alter what we're thinking, we'll take those into consideration. Then the whole package goes up to our regional director, who oversees all fish and wildlife operations in Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and Hawaii, and Robin Thorson, who that's mm-hmm. her name. She'll be making the decision on mm-hmm. sort of this EIS and where we go from there. So,
what's the funding situation with it? You know, you're 18th on in other words, quite high on a long list of wish list, I guess, for the service.
Right.
What happens next with that? If it gets a yes, how soon will you get a new headquarters?
Oh, that's it is a tough budget climate. And I will say this, the nice thing is, you know, when we talk about some of the work that we're doing, if we're talking about fishery work, we're working very closely with the Willapa Bay Regional Fishery Enhancement Group, and we're doing a lot of projects there. Forest management, it's with Nature Conservancy, we're working jointly with them. If we're talking about coastal dune and plovers, it's working with Taylor Shellfish, the Shoalwater Tribe, and the state on some of those things. So we have a lot of part of the Friends Group we mm-hmm. work a lot with. So there's a lot of ways that we can move forward on some of these items in the plan anyway. But when you're talking about, construction of new facilities or, even land acquisition, that's pretty much a congressionally funded type mm-hmm. situation. And I can't crystal ball what that is.
It's going to be a bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
If people want to comment, we have a front page story about this week, which provides the address. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that it's probably fairly easy to figure out on the internet how to provide comments.
Yeah. Just sending it in writing to mm-hmm. Addressing it to me and mailing it at our mailing address. Mm-hmm. Or if they don't have a copy of the document and they'd like a copy, and they can call our office at 360-484-3482, and we'll mail them a copy, a CD.
Okay, great. Well, it's been fun talking with you, Charlie. I think we could go on for hours about all the species that we're fans of, and I really do encourage people to go out and find their refuge. It's a refuge, not a park, so there aren't a lot of facilities, but it's a great place to walk and see wildlife. Many thanks again to KMUN, and this is Matt Winters, After Deadline.